fundamentally, it should be the creator's choice what can be done with their property. I think generally if someone decides that someone else needs to pay money for their music or for specific songs, I think that that's their business to ask for that, and they should be able to get that, and anyone who takes that right away from them, their right to control their own produce, should probably feel bad about themselves.
This is The Public. The Public is a weekly conversation about ideas and undercurrents in Canadian culture on CIUT 89.5. If you like what you hear, or if you don't, we're eager to hear from you. You can find us at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca or email us at thepublicconversation@gmail.com. Today on The Public, we're speaking with illustrator and musician Raymond Biesinger about prospects for people in creative careers, intellectual property rights, and Italian futurism. In addition to being a musician in, I'll call it a rock band, it's a guitar-based band, The Famines, Raymond Biesinger is a self-taught illustrator who hails from Edmonton, Alberta. His CV is very impressive, as he's published work in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Globe and Mail, Le Monde, Monocle, and he's contributed to ad campaigns and commercial projects for some of the world's best-known companies. Rather than rattling off the full list myself, I'll encourage the listeners to visit this show's blog, which is at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca, where I'll post more information. Or if you'd prefer to visit his site directly, it's at 15.ca. That's the word, not the numbers, 15.ca. Raymond, what's the significance of 15?
Oh, boy. See, it's funny because I really care about significance, and I really care about there being a purpose behind everything, and I really don't like decoration. Unfortunately, I chose my website URL in probably the year 2000 or 2001, and it has no relevance whatsoever to anything at all. It is not a business name. It isn't a brand name. I've never tried to use it in that way. It was just something that was easy to remember and short. And it, I have had on my list of things to do changing the URL for about 5 years now. But I just think of the pain in the ass of changing email addresses and redesigning things, and it just drives me crazy. So it lives on. Who knows how long it will. But yeah.
I thought there must be a story there. I wasn't sure what it would be. You could always make something up.
Yeah, but I'm so bad at lying. People would just be able to look right through that.
Fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've had we'll call it an outdated URL for the past 5 or 10 years, and that's since your commercial arts career started, mm-hmm, 10 years ago or more, would you tell us a little bit about your history? How, as a student of political science and history, you became a commercial artist and illustrator?
Absolutely. I moved to Edmonton from like a suburban community and some rural communities that I lived around, well, in the outskirts of Edmonton. Like, I'd lived there for a long time. I was born in Saskatchewan. And anyway, so 1999, I moved to Edmonton, and I went to University at U of A. And eventually, you know, I tried a lot of different things, and I landed in a history degree. And I really enjoyed it. History I find is just fascinating. History classes, when taught well, are a combination of like story time and critical thinking time. And I was really excited by that. And I mean, political science is kind of a cousin of history, although they have two very different approaches. But I mean, I was just excited by those combinations, and that led me to journalism. As much as you can call the student press journalism. So I was writing stories for the University of Alberta Gateway as like a news writer and an editorial. The managing editor, who is a pal, and his name's Mike Winters, and he currently does something in Toronto called Wonder Dick. Do you know about this?
I don't, but I wish I did with a name like that.
Yeah, well, he's a wonderful cartoonist, and he's hilarious, and he does satire very well. But told me one day he's looking for comics for the newspaper, and he always needed more, and he's like, Raymond, you can tell a good story, but you should just try making a comic. And I thought, yeah, sure. why not? Because, you know, I was into trying new things. And so I hadn't drawn anything since I was, like, 12 years old. And over the course of 8 weeks, I did 2 comics a week. And the comic strip was called Tiger. And I taught myself how to draw in that time. And I think the central tenets of what I'm doing now, well, at least some of them, were present in that. So I was working with limitations, like what I knew how to do, which wasn't much, rather than trying to pretend I was able to do something that other people were doing. So it was really, you know, it was black and white. It was dependent on, it was dependent on black lines and shapes and simple things. It wasn't too detail heavy. And also the concepts. I mean, it was a comic, and it was kind of indecipherable quite often. But if it was a conceptual thing, you could say that the concepts were not the easiest things to read. And I think all of those things I still do, where I'm always hesitant to go for the cliches. I try and avoid them. I'm okay with taking on a concept that isn't, you know, that will lose 20% of everyone or 50% of everyone, just for the sake of doing something more interesting. And of course, I'm still most at home and most excited when I'm working in a simple way, doing black and white, doing black and white plus one color. And nowadays, I'm even really excited about a new arm of my style that is entirely black lines on a white background, and just doing away with form and having it just be a single uniform line that constructs images. So I started doing that. And then I went on to do, like, editorial cartoons, like political cartoons for the newspaper, and it was kind of interesting to definitely not be a cartoonist, but using that format to examine politics and news. And eventually I was passed over for the managing editor job itself, and I was very angry. So I sent out a bunch of promotional packages, and I think I'm very generous in calling them promotional packages because they're more like envelopes stuffed with house party handbills. And I sent them to, like, Maclean's, the National Post, Globe and Mail, this magazine, Shift magazine, when it still existed. And to my utter and complete shock, they actually hired me, and it became my part-time job during university. After that, I graduated from university, tried being a full-time illustrator right away. That lasted about 8 months. And then I needed a part-time job for about 6 months. And I think it was Victoria Day long weekend in 2005 was the last time I needed to do anything but draw pictures.
That's a great career trajectory. We should all be so lucky.
It surprised the hell out of me. I think a lot of it comes from, I wanted to be a journalist and do writing, but I just looked around me and there are so many wonderful, skilled people who had far more drive than I did. And schools were cranking out a lot of journalists, and just that media landscape didn't look too promising. So I decided, I'll develop an aesthetic sense and try and make some money off of it and look at art as journalism in a way.
We'll get into contractions in the journalism landscape and in the landscape of outlets for creative production in a few minutes. That's where the second half of the conversation will go. But I want to ask you about something you said just a minute ago. You said that you're really excited by simple things, and yet I know a little something about your process when it comes to making illustrations, and I wouldn't describe it as simple.
Well, I think there might be a psychological element to this, where it's not like I get to look at a lot of what other illustrators do to make their images. So I think it might be easy for me to assume that what I'm doing is simple. If you look at it, like, what I'm doing is I am taking, like, found and made geometric shapes and objects. You know, I'll use an X-Acto blade to cut out a shape out of a piece of foam core, or I'll take an old photograph of mine and cut out a shadow, and I'll basically collage all these things together. For the sake of speed, I'll use a computer to help that along, of course. And so I'm using the computer as like a scissors and glue and a Xerox machine. And it is something that you can do by hand. It would take a lot more time. To me, this is simple, like, because because I'm reusing shapes constantly. I'm reusing items that I've made. I'm reusing photographs that I've taken that have an inherent texture. And so there's a simplicity in that, you know, I've made hundreds of drawings using the same ingredients in a way. And I don't think I'll call that laziness. Maybe I'll call it haste and also just a recognition that when you reuse the same elements over and over, you know, you establish a visual vocabulary. And that's an interesting thing to play with.
And how would you describe your typography?
Amateur. It's funny. There's I was just asked by a design company to do like a typography based poster, and I said, you know, there's a reason that I don't advertise myself as a typographer or designer, and that's because the way that I do text is really backwards. It's really inflexible. Basically, I'm cutting and pasting individual letters. I'm assembling letters. It's really not that flexible. And so when I do typography, I do it for my band or I do it for my personal projects. But the like with illustration, it's like there's a process where it's like, oh, three roughs, you know, rough sketches. They choose whichever one they want to go with. And then you do it, and with typography, for me, it's kind of like, well, I don't know how if it's going to work until I actually do it. And it's really, I just think I could see in a commercial environment it being really awkward for me to pretend to be a typographer.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm.
So would you describe your work as abstract then?
No, I wouldn't. It would be a conceptual illustration. It would be minimalist. It would be research-driven and as factual as possible. I really like playing very close to the material that I have to accompany as an illustrator and getting details right and correct. I think as well there are other facets, like I shun decoration. I'm not excited about anything that doesn't serve the concept or the purpose of an image. This carries on to my personal work as well. I feel like the way that being an illustrator and responding to assignments constantly, and there always needing to be a thesis or a theme or something that's accompanied, has really meant, I don't know, for some reason I can't even imagine making personal work without having a strong individual argument that needs to be illustrated.
And on that point, much of your work is grounded in a profound sense of place. You've done an alternate civic crest for Edmonton.
Yeah.
You've screen printed visual distillations of several Canadian cities, including Toronto. How does your sense of place, your citizenship, where you find yourself, inform your work?
Well, that's an interesting one. I think I can tell you why I do that. And I think that it's, we live in Canada. We live in a place that could be described globally as like culturally peripheral. A lot of movies are set in Toronto or Montreal, but most of the time we're doubling for St. Louis or something like that. And I think that mass culture really skips over most of Canada. And I think that it's really important that people, instead of just fawning over New York and the Brooklyn Bridge and what's happening in that scene, I think it's really important in this day and age that that individuals make art and make creative output that is reflective of regional things and local things. And so in Edmonton, I made an alternate version of the Edmonton Civic Crest, and it was an improvement on the real thing, in my opinion, and it's a pretty funny thing.
Would you describe it for us?
Yeah, sure, if I can remember correctly. The real Edmonton Civic Crest is, there's a shield, and there are two figures on either side and a crown up top. And then there's a flag with three words on the bottom. And in the real one, it's industry, integrity, and progress, which are the slogan of Edmonton. And I replaced that with poop, rickets, and vice, which are just the first three stupid words I could think of. Silly. But the character on the left is, the character on the right is Minerva, the Greek goddess of wisdom. And in the real crest, she is wearing, she's holding the book of knowledge. But on my crest, she has the severed head of the pioneering spirit, which is the Davy Crockett kind of character opposite her on the crest. Because I think that there's a certain myth about Westerners being great entrepreneurs and pioneers, when in fact, you know, all of the economics of success of the West is based upon resource exploitation. Then, let's see, the Davy Crockett character, his head is in her arms, of course, so his head is replaced by a Soviet flag with a hammer and sickle, because Edmonton is known locally as Redmonton, because it's the only place in Alberta that doesn't vote conservative. There are other things, like on the real crest, there's the rising sun of optimism, and I've replaced that with like a hazardous flammable sign in reflection of the East Edmonton Gas Works. It goes on and on.
You're very reverential towards your subject, obviously.
Yeah, well, it comes from a place of love, though. I mean, Edmonton is worth making things that reflect it. And I think that it's spoofing the official notions of Edmonton as like a world-class city where everything is perfect and we're all business geniuses and we're all conservative. So it's attacking stereotypes, and it's been really, like, that particular image is really being adopted by people there as the true crest. Like, I get emails every once in a while, strangers telling me that they have that tattooed on their leg and stuff like that. And there was even, like, a beer league hockey team that almost adopted that as their logo. So I think that, you know, a city like Edmonton, the people crave and people are excited about art that reflects their existence there. And when you get a piece like that, or a graphic or an art book like Jillian Tamaki's City of Champions, or Dave Barry and Josh Hollinati from Edmonton made something called We Hate This Place Here, It's Our Home. You know, I had a bunch of friends over just yesterday and with a giant stack of graphic novels, and a lot of people were former Edmontonians, and they just gravitated towards that stuff. Yeah. So yeah, to continue a little bit, the Toronto, Montreal, Quebec City, Ottawa prints, those were efforts for me to try and understand this region as well as I did Edmonton. And so each of them, they're like a 24-inch square silkscreen print that show Toronto, Ottawa, Quebec City, Montreal during specific points during their history, and each one has about like 30 to 50 different specific buildings and landmarks on them illustrated, and each one of them comes from a specific time. So it's like Toronto on the day the CN Tower opened in 1976. So I made that for a very personal reason, but also people are just really excited to see their hometown analyzed and illustrated in a way that isn't just some stupid T-shirt that says Toronto on it.
So you strive to understand the place that you're representing far more than just drawing a caricature of it with a happy sun wearing sunglasses in the background, it sounds.
Yeah,
like.
And I think in illustration right now, I mean, there are a lot of people who are excited about local culture and local produce, and I can see clearly that there are a lot of illustrators and designers who are trying to make a lot of money off of, you know, these local and regional sensibilities. I don't know, I'm just often disappointed when it's just like, oh, you made a Toronto print, cool, there's the CN Tower, oh, that's a trademarked image, and you didn't go much deeper than that.
Right.
So I'm excited to give more depth to this. These images are things where you can look at them a million times, and there are some buildings that you won't even recognize until you'll run into them on the street and be like, oh, that was that one. I'm excited by that, and as I said, I think it's important that we make art that discusses, examines local and regional culture, because mass culture sure isn't doing that.
So how do you balance that then with your own internationalist career? I mean, you were recently commissioned to do a series of pieces on Italian futurism, of all things, for an Italian magazine.
Yeah, well, I think there's a certain amount of Robin Hood going on here, where I'll work with the big international clients, and I'll get as good of a deal as possible out of that, and I will use that to fund totally dicey things that may or may not make financial sense at all, that reflect local things. The case of that Italian futurist stuff, though, that was just fascinating from beginning to end. And basically, there's Italy's like the largest business magazine, like I'm gonna say this wrong. I think it's like Il Or 24 or something like that. I think it translates to like the sun 24 hours. And they have a section that's in the magazine that is called Rana. And it's a literary magazine. It's designed in a totally different style that's within the larger magazine. And it's designed in the style of Italian futurism, or futurist publications in the 1920s and 30s. And so they approached me and basically said, we want you to, we have like a cover, a back cover, three spreads, six full pages, like like a dozen quarter pages and half pages and stuff, and we want you to do whatever you want, and we actually have a good budget. And that's really exciting because increasingly I'm being, people are excited about my ability as a writer and like initiating concepts and stuff. So I decided to examine, Italian's premier art movement of the 20th century being Italian futurism. And, so I researched them, looked into their manifestos, and just came up with a theme of, you know, what would the Italian futurists think of the actual future being the present day. And that was a lot of fun and kind of eye-opening. And they really liked what I did as well.
So can you speak to that, to the tradition of futurism, what it means as a philosophy and why they chose you specifically?
I think it's funny. I really hadn't heard of this magazine before. I could see that they gave me samples of their previous issues, and it looked like they were hiring a bunch of people who kind of looked like they were doing what I was doing. And then they gave me an offer, and I was like, it's a little cheap, but they really managed to find a lot of money for me. So it's clear that they're really excited to pick me. Anyway, I don't know. Well, they really wanted me to do this, and there was considerable enthusiasm, and they gave me a really free hand. Like, usually there's a, you know, you give three roughs, and they choose one. I just gave them one rough per image. They ended up publishing as well all of my rough images and all of my notes that I wrote along with the roughs explaining the images, which is kind of crazy. And they bought the rights to do that, so it was totally legit. But so they were clearly excited about what I was doing and saw a bit of Italian futurism in what I was doing. I just grabbed, like, I've read, have you read Simon Reynolds' Retromania?
No, I haven't.
Well, it's an amazing book. It's a British music critic wrote this. Came out in 2012, I think, and it talks about how our generation, or at least, you know, modern Western society, is more fixated on the recent history than any generation previously. Like, the ancient Romans admired the ancient Greeks, but there was a millennia in between those two cultures' high points. And so we, because of the internet, are so easy to access and are so enthused about everything that's happened since 1940 or so. And so much of modern art can be just seen as like a recombination of those things. And so the futurists, they have some really negative things going on with their ideas. Like, they are total warmongers, and, I mean, they're proto-fascists, and they hate women. However, they also had an enthusiasm for the new and a worship for creativity regardless of what the outcome is. And a desire to experiment. And I think that's really exciting and something that's missing from a lot of music culture these days and from visual culture. It was interesting to look at that and to, you know, I mean, they loved, Marinetti was one. F.M. Marinetti, I think, was his name.
Mm-hmm.
One of the head futurists. And in his manifesto, he's like, we should divert streams so that we can flood the museums and we can flood the academic institutions and we can flood the schools and we can flood the archives and we can destroy the past and that'll be great. And, you know, there's one illustration I did that was simply the Italian Museum of Modern Art with banners advertising a futurist retrospective.
Nice.
And just simply being like, oh, well, these guys are being celebrated. How would they feel about that, given that in their original manifesto, Marinetti wrote about being really excited when he's 35 that some, like, 20-year-old artist is going to come and, like, slit his throat. He's going to love that.
Being replaced, being overtaken by...
Yeah. He's like, by that point, our ideas will be stupid, and it will be great that people will eliminate us because we will be past our prime. The irony of this is Marinetti went on to... he pioneered futurist poetry, futurist painting, futurist architecture, and eventually he opened up a futurist restaurant chain in the 1930s, and then eventually he got a job teaching art as well, so he became exactly what he hated. It's fascinating, but that impulse of newness in the idea that it is possible to make something new, and we just don't all have to be collage artists of different things that have been produced over the last 50 years.
This the retromania idea that you mentioned that Simon Reynolds introduced in his book, that's really interesting because as recently as the 20th century, there are so many topics that have been inadequately explored or explained or taught to us. I know you produced a book on the First World War in 20 illustrations in, 2,000 words?
1,000 words, yeah.
Could you speak about that process, the end result, mining recent history for new understandings?
Well, it's interesting because there is a certain irony that I'm so excited about futurism and trying something new, but I am very excited about history. And you could argue that my style is embedded in the past a little bit as well. As far as the First World War goes, I'm just very excited about, well, not excited, I am terrified and fascinated by that time. And I know that in the abstract we all understand that war is a horrible thing. I think the First World War is very easily, people talk about, again, in the abstract, how war is horrible, but at the same time that, Vimy Ridge in 1917 is held up as like one of the foundational moments of Canadian history. And so I think as wars kind of recede into the past, for some reason they seem a little cleaner in the public eye. But the First World War was this tremendous, awkward event where industrialized society was able to create these awful, awful machines of death, and we really didn't even understand the ramifications of what we were making, or at least, yeah. And so you get these terrifying inventions, like, say, the British Mark III tank, I think, and it's like a 54 chunk of steel that runs on treads, and all the farm boys in the trenches and the city boys had never seen anything like this, something so large that doesn't run on tracks. And it is enormous, and, you know, tanks changed the war. They broke
the impasse of the trench warfare, certainly.
Absolutely. And so these are, you know, technologically, they achieved their goal. However, they were such flawed devices to the point where, like, the gas tanks on the early versions were in the ceiling of the crew compartment, meaning a single shot on the lightly armored top would rain awful, awful flames and death and gas onto the crew. Or how, like, radio hadn't quite been, well, invented then. So in order to communicate with the back lines and to headquarters, these tanks had two little hatches on either side where they would let little carrier pigeons out the side. And there's just something so crazy to me about this enormous modern piece of technology that weighs 54 tons and shoots death, depending on like a 2-pound ball of feathers to communicate. Or there was a crew member who was known as the runner, whose job was to just get drunk in the vehicle on what they called fortified milk. And he would take a message, and in the heat of battle, he would just have to sprint as fast as he could out the back of the tank. You can look at other things like, we see images of the First World War, quite often the soldiers are wearing helmets. I mean, Canadians didn't actually fight with helmets until 1917. For some reason, we didn't think that was a good idea until then. It's crazy, and it really shouldn't be forgotten. War is a very disgusting thing, and that book, I think, helps point people in that direction, although because it's so short, yeah, I'm definitely motivated to make something far more explanatory and on a much larger scale.
Well, I don't want to write off that book using... this is going to sound pejorative, but I don't mean it that way.
Mm-hmm.
The book is... the way you've represented the war, it's almost infographic.
Yeah.
In that it's obviously graphic. It's... The illustrations themselves are communications of information
mm-hmm.
as much as they are conceptual.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think that says about the subject, the way it's understood now, the way you approached it?
Well, this is funny because, I mean, I know that there are limitations to how I draw things, and there's limitations to how I make things. And, like, I'm working now on a larger book that is the Cold War, although basically the history of the 20th century. And it's on a much larger scale. And I know, I mean, I've read a lot, and right out of high school, I read a lot about the Gulag and the Holocaust, this kind of thing, like the large, the darkest moments of the 20th century. And I look at my style and how it is infographic and how it does not have emotion. And you know, that's something I strive for in illustration, where it's like, I want to portray rational argument. I will not draw faces. I will not draw emotional elements. Everything is very neutral. And there was a time when I was working, you know, studying, you know, the Gulag and Soviet Russia in the 1930s, you know, just brushing up and thinking, you know, this is actually kind of cold. Like, I'm drawing these absolutely awful, awful moments where there's so much pain and so much unnecessary death, and I can't even make a sad face, you know, in the illustrations. And so I've thought about that, and that's something I think I'm going to need to address in the introduction of this book, where to be so clinical to such a thing is a disservice to the amount of pain that's been felt about that, you know, the considerable amount of pain. I forget the rest of your question, but that really weighs on my mind, and I think that that's a real problem with these books. And because I think there's a large written component to the new one that I'm making, I think perhaps the written component will be able to have more emotion than the relatively cold infographic quality and illustration qualities that I have.
But you made a conscious decision to remove or... restrict the level of emotion that you contain in your illustrations, haven't you?
Yeah, I think that I'm seeing in this project how that is, it's forcing things in a direction that me personally, I don't know if I'm entirely comfortable with. As I say, I'm going to try to address that in the component of the project that isn't illustration and that is writing. It's a conscious direction I've went in, and it's a big part of what I do and what I can do as an illustrator. And yeah, it's something that I think needs to be remedied in this case.
You've described your work, your art style, as mechanical and inhuman.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do those qualities inform what you choose to illustrate, or is it a result of what you choose to illustrate that makes your art style so...
You know, I think that I've chosen that direction from early on. Like, I can remember for probably up until 2006, I actually avoided using the human form as much as possible. And to the point where, like, I would say I probably drew my first full body of a human being in about 2006 or so. And it's only comparatively recently, in the last 3 or 4 years, that I've actually been comfortable drawing images or drawing human beings, and it still feels like a cop-out quite often. I think because I'm so excited about finding interesting concepts, one of the surest ways to make an interesting concept is just to have a ban on the human form, and suddenly you're forced to find a completely different vocabulary to express something.
It's a very rigorous discipline you've applied.
It used to be, at least. I think I'm more and more comfortable with drawing individuals, but I catch myself thinking, I don't want to rest on this crutch too much. I want to be able to think, you know, more abstractly, but still having these, or think think more symbolically and find interesting ways to combine symbolism instead of just using the crutch of showing a person doing this or showing a person doing that or doing a portrait.
Well, let's speak about that a little more then and talk about the commercial arts themselves. You're a commercial artist.
Yes.
You're an illustrator who makes his living selling illustrations. Mm-hmm. You're in a rock and roll band, so again, aiming to sell records.
Yeah.
And yet on this subject, and on the subject of the prospects for current and future commercial artists, you wrote a piece called Doom.
Yes, I did.
Would you introduce us to that piece and to your general thesis in it?
Absolutely. It was a talk. The Student Design Association at the U of A heard that I was coming back to Edmonton, and they asked me to do a talk. And they let me do whatever I wanted. And I know quite often in that situation, people just be like, want to talk about the work they've done. But I decided to decide on a thesis and just talk about it for an hour. And so the result was a talk called Doom, and the subtitle is a talk about the future of commercial art. I've been in bands for a long time. I think I joined my first one in 1992 or so, and I've probably toured the country 7 or 8 times since then, from Victoria to Halifax. And I've also participated, I coordinated a project and made something called The Chart, and it is a 26-foot-long by 18-inch-tall chart documenting Edmonton's music scene going back to 1950 to 2010. And over the course of doing that, it was kind of a exercise in community memory. So, I would send all my friends and be like, hey, tell me every band that you're ever in and everyone who was in those bands, and tell me what bands they were in too. And slowly I got more and more information crawling back and back through Edmonton's music scene until I was hearing from people who had toured the prairies in the 1930s in jazz bands. And in the end, you can still see the chart online, and there's a paper version of it, and it documents the careers of something like 500 musicians and 200 bands from Edmonton. And so when doing this, people would submit a lot of stories to me about how music was in other eras, and I would get to interview a lot of scene old-timers from the 50s and 60s. And, of course, I'm interested in economics and the economics of creativity. So I asked them a lot about, how much they're getting paid and just what it was like to be a musician at the time. And it's funny, I think a lot of people see right now as a golden age for music because the internet allows everyone to listen to everything. It really is a golden age for the listener, I think. But from talking to all these people, I realized that since the 1960s, the ability for musicians to make a living being musicians has declined a great deal. I mean, it used to be that a musician in Edmonton could play moderately challenging pop music in the style of the Beatles in the mid-60s, and they could tour around to, a dozen or 2 dozen communities in central and northern Alberta, and they could play every night of the week. And because of the fact that there was less entertainment options for people, because there was, just live music was something that people paid more attention to back then. Way more people. And, since then, music has become far more exciting and captivating to more people, and everyone wants to be a star. And it's, recording technology has become a lot cheaper, so the barriers to entry to being a musician are so much smaller. And it's harder, of course, for musicians to actually sell music. And when people use the internet to try and find music, most of them are using it to find, global acts, New York acts. They're not trying to look at regional and local acts. Anyway, so my point being is that music was increasingly becoming hobbyized to the point where it used to be quite possible, if you wanted to make a living wage being a musician. But nowadays, good luck with that. So using that as kind of the background for the talk, I decided, wouldn't it be interesting to think about all the other commercial arts, like illustration, photography, writing, drama, you name it, dance, all kinds of things, and look at it through the same lens and see how technology is changing and how the desirability of these jobs is increasing and how the culture of free on the internet affects things, and see how, well, actually, I found that all of these things are becoming hobbyized, much like music has been. So it's a great time for people to have a pair of eyes, but if you intend to be an illustrator and make a living wage off of it for the rest of your life, it's far, far more harder than it ever used to be.
We spoke on this program just a couple of weeks ago with a commercial photographer and videographer, Clayton Cubitt.
Mm-hmm.
And he was arguing that Instagram for photography is making the population as a whole more fluent in the language of aesthetics and visual composition.
Mm-hmm.
He sees this as a rising standard for the whole population, and he sees it as a good thing because it'll push artists further. What do you think of this, of the idea of breadth of fluency as opposed to narrower heights of accomplishment?
Oh, I have no doubt that people are becoming more educated and more have a better visual knowledge of things. The big issue is that those same people are at the same time are being taught that they don't have to pay in order to see things. So I have no doubt that people are making absolutely fantastic things, and I have no doubt that hobbyists can make wonderful things, and I have no doubt that that professionals who can dedicate their full lives to making things are making beautiful things. However, those professionals are having a harder time actually getting money in their own pockets. I think that in certain cities, people are insulated from that, like in Toronto or Montreal. But, I mean, if you think about, like, how many photographers there used to be around the country and how few these days can get by on anything but doing wedding photographers, they're doing wedding photography. It's really shocking. And even, like, in the case of illustration, it used to be in what year was it? I'm going to get all my numbers wrong, but they're going to be in the ballpark right here. But it used to be in the 1920s and 30s, an illustrator could do the cover of, like, the Saturday Evening Post and make $40,000. It was a very specialized skill.
Adjusted for inflation, right?
Yeah, so okay. it's even more ridiculously well paid. And everything since then has been a decline wage-wise. Like, by the 1960s, you could do a spread for Cosmopolitan magazine and get, you know, $14,000 or so. By the 90s, that was going down even further. By the time, like, even to look at, you know, in my recent memory, say I did the Facts and Arguments page illustration for the Globe and Mail in the year 2003, and I got paid $500 for it. I was a brand new illustrator. I didn't negotiate a number. I just took what was given to me. These days, I have friends who take that very same assignment, and it's a larger image, and they're getting paid a third of that, even though they're far more esteemed and high-quality illustrators than I was at that time. So you can, in the last 10 years alone, like, fees for illustration have gone down an enormous amount. And I'm very lucky. I've got my shit together. I've taken advantages of situations like, I mean, the Edmonton Journal basically paid my rent for, like, the first 5 years that I was learning how to be an illustrator. You know, I was accompanying a column every week, and they let me experiment. I was learning, and I was making a living doing it, which gave me a lot of time to try a lot of things. These days, there's no way a daily newspaper in Canada is going to have a budget for that kind of thing. And I don't care what people say, the more you're paid to do something, the more time you're going to have to do it. And, that said, there is a flip side, and yes, like, hobbyists or amateurs, and I don't use the word amateur in a pejorative way, they can do things that people who function within an economy can't. However, I think that the world is better if they're hobbyists and professionals, and I really do see professionals being under siege.
So there are two things that you said that I'd like to follow up on. The first is about the going rates for the commercial arts declining quite steadily. I'm wondering, what do you think the factors are that contribute to that? Do you think it's the fewer publications per capita, meaning it's a buyer's market now, or do you think it's, you know, the decline of media in general, or do you think it's just the arts themselves are becoming less valued, or?
I think that it's a supply and demand thing where being an illustrator and just generally being someone who is creative is far, far more desirable than it ever has been. I mean, when I think about the number of people around me who have spent their 20s and 30s trying to set up a situation where they get to do what they want to do instead of doing what our parents did.
Which How dare they be so...
Pardon?
How dare they think such things?
Well, I mean, I'm observing. I'm not judging.
Oh, no. I mean, but, I think that's a noble ambition is to want to do what you want to do.
Yeah, and it's a new idea. I mean, our parents and our grandparents, the vast majority of them did not think, you know, oh, I want to be a rock star or, oh, I want to be an artist, you know. And so there's just so much desirability. And I think that since the 1960s, I mean, the idea that your job and every single moment of your life needs to be an expression of your own, you know, creativity and individuality, like that's a relatively new idea. And it's only gotten stronger since the 1960s. And you know, generations of parents have taught, you know, a lot of people being like, oh, you can do what you want. Yeah, go to art school. Go for it. And so there are just so many more people who have taken artistic training and who are excited about creative work. And at the same time, there is, media is definitely changing in terms of newspapers and magazines, which is like... The pay hasn't been great for a long time, so it's kind of like, there's less and less money in that way as far as assignments go. And as a result, there are more illustrators with idle hands, and then when big commercial projects come, they know that people are more desperate than they've ever been to get work. And so they know that, you know, previously what would be a $50,000 job, they're offering $20,000, and people are taking it. At the same time, illustration is a very... it's a very solitary pursuit. And like in Canada, the organization, the Association of Photographers and Illustrators, is a joke. I feel totally comfortable saying that. And no one is really teaching illustrators and photographers what they're worth. There's no really concerted effort to keep prices high and to even to educate clients about what is good conduct and what's taking advantage of an illustrator. So I think that creatives like photographers and illustrators are just being walked on. Another element is the notion of clip art. You know, since the 1990s, there have been CDs and websites that just take a million old illustrations that are public domain, or some illustrator has sold them for a pittance, and you know, magazines and newspapers and clients can just take clip photography and clip art and pay a fraction of the cost of commissioning something new. There are a lot of factors that are leading towards this.
And then contributing to it is this unwillingness by the part of so many people to pay for creative products, whether it's downloading music for free or what have you. You wrote, quote, "The respect for the music exists, obviously. The listener finds it, downloads it, enjoys it. But there's a separation between the music and the human who made it."
Yeah, totally.
So what do you think this bodes for us as consumers and producers of culture?
Well, I think that we might be entering the era of the hobbyist, and I think that if we look at this in a larger theme, I mean, I think in general in North America, jobs are harder and harder to come by, especially good-paying jobs. And you can see this in all kinds of economic indicators. You can see it in statistics that say that, you know, my generation is the first generation to in a very long time to actually have a lower standard of living than our parents. You can look at it in unemployment statistics for youth, which I think are higher than they've been in a very long time. I think that let's just say I'm not too much of an optimist as to the shape of the world and the idea that I'm falling all over my tongue here. I think that the world generally, a major theme that is going on right now is the rich are getting very much richer, and the middle class is slowly, you know, dropping into lower class income levels. And I think that the fact that it's harder for illustrators to get work is, you know, much in agreement with some other sectors like manufacturing and this kind of thing. So money is just going to be harder and harder to come by, and I think a lot of people are going to be forced just to take what they can get instead of trying to be a professional creative. So, yeah.
You spoke earlier about the war machines of the First World War and how in their creation we really had no idea what we were producing, and I wonder if the same thing could be said about the internet. What do you think about piracy and the protection of intellectual property?
Well, I think fundamentally it should be the creator's choice what can be done with their property. I think generally if someone decides that someone else needs to pay money for their music or for specific songs, I think that that's their business to ask for that, and they should be able to get that, and anyone who takes that right away from them, their right to control their own produce, should probably feel bad about themselves. I think it's been really interesting to see how commentary about the internet and its effects on culture have changed over the last 10 years. Like, I remember it felt like for the first 5 years of the 2000s, the first 7 years of the 2000s, every single journalist who was into music was just talking about how wonderful it was that everything was free and that taking music is like sticking it to record companies, and, you know, big bad record companies at that. And it's been interesting over the last 3-4 years maybe to start seeing journalists realize, oh, there's a cost to this. And yeah, sure, MCA and Universal or whatever aren't making as much money as they used to, but also musicians are getting shafted hard. This hasn't been a wonderful, I mean, there have been exceptions, obviously, but en masse, like, musicians as individuals are getting shafted by these technologies. And it's interesting to see more and more musicians do away with the idea of projecting an aura of success and actually saying, oh yeah, like, I'm super poor and this sucks, and you people who aren't paying me for my music, you're responsible for this in great part.
How do you think Canada compares then around the world?
I know a lot about Canada's music scene. I don't know much about like independent music in the States and elsewhere. That's a blind spot of mine, but I mean, it's expensive to cross the border and figure out what's going on down there as a band.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. You said you aren't much of an optimist when it comes to the commercial arts and the creative arts as a financially sustainable pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, despite this sense of doom, you remain a commercial artist.
Well, that's because as an individual, I'm doing very well, and I'm in a very sweet spot. As I said, I started doing what I was doing at a very good time for me. I mean, I was totally broke when I started, so I had no expectations. B, you know, I managed to talk the Edmonton Journal into, as I said, paying for my rent for 5 years while I experimented and figured stuff out. And so I was able to take advantage of that. And so nowadays that doesn't exist, it doesn't affect me anymore really, because, you know, I'm at a point where I've managed to turn, you know, a bunch of doing assignments for other people into I can make a bunch of prints and I can make a bunch of books and they actually make money, and that's more and more of my income. So I'm less dependent on the assignment system than I used to be, because I kind of built up a name for myself and built up an audience, as it were, by using that. So I've kind of passed, you know, that starting off phase. I've done that. You know, I'm 10 years into this, and I don't have to worry so much about a lot of things. And I actually have savings and that kind of thing, which is very nice. For a lot of people starting out, though, I think it would be really daunting to just think, oh my God, how do I actually make rent being an illustrator? And it seems like it's something that people try for 2 or 3 years doing full-time, and then just decide the grind is too much, and most of them stop and turn it into a part-time thing. And that's cool. I have some amazingly talented friends who are doing that and making work that makes my jaw drop. But I can't help but to think it would be an amazing world in which those people could just do their art full time.
So what's next for you? Do you have any projects on the books?
Yeah. I am doing my largest collection of silkscreen prints in spring. The largest one I've ever done. I'm coming up with like 8 new prints. Hilariously, one of them is called How It's Made. And it is an 18 by 24 one color. It's in that line style that I'm really excited about. It's just lines and not forms. And basically, it is it's a giant factory, and in it are about 30 or 40 different rooms. Inside one of them is me drawing, and in every other one is all of the other unromantic like things that one must do as a commercial artist in order to be a commercial artist. So there's like the negotiation room, there's the photo reference room, there's the library, there's the massive incinerator in which you throw all the roughs that don't see the light of day. There's all the materials that you would use. There's the very tiny apartment in the bottom right-hand corner of the factory that represents your truncated social and domestic life. So I think it's aesthetically a beautiful thing, but also it's very factual and perhaps aims to debunk the idea that creativity is all about making beautiful things, and in fact there's a tough slog that's attached to it as well.
The Public is a weekly conversation about ideas and undercurrents in Canadian culture on CIUT 89.5. If you have something you'd like to add, please be in touch. You can find us at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca or through ciut.fm. You can also email us at thepublicconversation@gmail.com. That's our show this week. We hope you'll tune in again. To close today's show, we're going to seize the opportunity and play Italian futurist music. Warning, it's abrasive. First, we'll hear Gorgogliatore by Luigi Rossolo, and we'll follow it with Aeroduello by Luigi Grandi. Hope you enjoy.